in my business life, I knew it was just only two things counting. You know what it was? What's the price? What's the deal?
Yeah.
Went right for it. But this is the price. This is the deal.
You won't find that here.
Well, actually, it is just like that in the Bible. What's your price? What's your deal? Believe on the Lord Jesus Christ, thou shalt be saved. It's right there. That's the sales pitch.
That's the sales pitch. That's your 20-second elevator pitch right there. We might actually have to keep that. Welcome, everybody, to Classroom 33, the podcast. Pastor Dustin is here again with Steve Prudian, and today we are talking about the 8th chapter of Job. This is the first accusations that are being made by the one and only Bildad. And if you are anything like me by the end of this conversation, you probably won't like Bildad very much. Steve, how are you doing today?
I don't like Bildad either, but you know what? Anytime a Bill shows up in my house, I don't like it.
You know, when I was a kid, bills used to go to Dad.
That's right, because Dad pays the bills. Yeah. The buck stops here.
All right. Who is Bildad? It does us some good to know who these people are. So who is Bildad?
Well, you know, there's a lot of strange names in the Bible. And they're just a name until we put an identity to a name, because a person who has a voice, who is saying things to another person, is a true and living character. But all of us have influences from our past, from our families, and from our training. And Bildad is no different. A lot of people don't know that Bildad was a grandson of Abraham. A lot of people do not know that Abraham got married again after Sarah had died.
Even though it says it, right?
Right.
Right in chapter 25.
Yes, it is. And he married a lady by the name of Keturah. Yep. She wasn't Jewish, by the way.
It's not a very Jewish name.
There wasn't any Jews at this point in time.
Well.
Okay. But she was an Arabic woman. And what happened is she had a son by the name of Shuhan. And Shuhan fathered Bildad. But what's interesting is Bildad in the Hebrew, it means she knows. I still want to know what she knows, because apparently Shuhan doesn't know. Now, Abraham, he lived actually for 175 years, and he had 6 more sons. They didn't count the daughters.
Nobody did.
No. We're not going to get into that, though.
No. We'll skip over that.
But what happened was is that Abraham had this apparatus that in a priority, and his priority was is that his God-given son of promise, his name was Isaac.
Correct.
And Abraham was willing to sacrifice Isaac, which we know, because if that's what God had demanded him, to basically show his love and faithfulness for God. Mm-hmm. But because of that price, Abraham was very protective of Isaac, to the point that he listened to Sarah and sent his other son and her handmaiden away so there wouldn't be competition for Isaac.
Right.
After Abraham had 6 more sons, he didn't want Isaac to have any competition or to basically have any fighting between brothers. Mm-hmm. So Abraham did the smart thing. He took his other 6 sons, and he sent them further away to different countries to the east. Now, Bildad, he actually settled in what will be classified as Palestine today. And in reality, the part of Palestine that he settled in became the land of the Philistines. Isn't it amazing how you could have the same godly father to create enemies for the people of promise?
It's something that actually shows up a couple of different times. And there's no doubt in my mind, anyways, in the study that I've done and the looking that I've done, that there are plenty of, we'll say, competing religions that stem from the sons of Abraham.
That's right. You know what's interesting? The key word is sons.
Correct.
Do you know what is common between all children, even of the same family?
The father.
The father. However, children seem to go their own way, in spite of the father's instructions. And subsequently, when they do go their own way, they develop their own philosophies, their own worship, and unfortunately, most of them are laced with bias and prejudice.
It is the unfortunate truth, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It's called human nature. However, if you're wise and you read the Bible, you'll understand who the spoiler is. And it's because of that spoiler that people have strange and different and competing beliefs.
Yes, it is. Yes, it absolutely is. I like how you call him a spoiler. That's great. He spoils everything.
Even today.
Even today.
Even today.
He spoils everything. Good. Well, let's go. Let's go back to Bildad here.
Okay.
And his approach to accosting Job is quite different than the one that Eliphaz took. So what kind of makes those different?
Personalities. A lot of his personalities.
Fair enough.
Eliphaz probably was a little more refined, probably a little more philosophical, probably a little more diplomatic because he was the Prince of Edom. Bildad was just a camel trader. Okay?
Right.
You know, Bildad's out for what Bildad could get for it. He wants to get this thing over quick. You can tell by the dialogue. It's very short compared to Eliphaz. He doesn't really want to have a conversation with Job. He just wants to throw him under the bus and give him the knife.
Right. Right. And, you know, one of the things that kind of stands out, we don't know anything about Shua.
No.
Other than he's named a couple of different places that helps us to connect Abraham to Bildad. But we do know that Eliphaz was a son of Esau. And Esau, I mean, his brother totally stole everything from him as far as
birthright, the blessing.
The birthright and the blessing. And
but it was conditional. Part of it was voluntary.
He did do it to himself in some respect. But at their last meeting that's recorded in the Bible, there's forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
And so we know that Esau understands forgiveness, at least human forgiveness. And so it's likely that Eliphaz does as well, because his approach seems to be a little bit more from the positive, on the positive spin of you must have done something wrong, otherwise it would look like this, whereas Bildad is saying, well, if you did it right, good things happen, but you must have done something absolutely terrible. And then, you know, and to start it off, I mean, he kind of makes you mad right at the beginning because he starts it off at attacking those who are not there to defend themselves.
He even attacked those who weren't even part of the dialogue and the equation between Job and his faith in God.
Well, he attacked Job's children, which is in our culture, say what you want about America right now, but it's still pretty well respected that you don't speak ill of the dead. And this wound is still really fresh for Job. His kids have all died tragically and suddenly. And Bildad goes and blames them for his problems.
He went one step further. Of course, he says the sins, the children must have sinned. Yep. But what he's saying is that your sacrifice that you made for them wasn't good enough. Mm-hmm. That's what he's saying to Job. He says, you may have done a sacrifice, he says, but it wasn't good enough. That's why they're dead.
Now we're going back to Cain and Abel. Except you've got Job who's giving a sacrifice to God and God's accepting it and calling him righteous.
And then for each and every child, he slaughtered an animal and sacrificed an animal for each and every child. He didn't do what was called a communal sacrifice.
Right, for each child and the servants, and he did extra sacrifices for unknown sins and all sorts of different things. I mean, there was no cost too great for him to sacrifice for the eternal well-being of his children.
Do you ever think that maybe Bildad was a little jealous at Job and Job's wealth, and now he's rubbing it in now that he's lost it all?
Oh, he could be. He very well could be.
You have to ask yourself this question. Why would you leave home, make a trip, leave your business, leave your family? For what purpose? What are you going to get out of it? Satisfaction?
Usually of some sort.
We don't know the answer to that, but you know the thing is just in reading the tone of his words, the attitude of his speech to Job, you find that this guy has a dark attitude.
He does. And it could very well be you've lived a long life having lots, and I've lived my whole life having nothing. And now you have what I've always had, and you're complaining about it, and I just got to deal with it. I've known a few people like that in my life.
It's human nature.
It's human nature.
Human nature. Don't try to figure it out. You got to go to the root of it, and the root is rotten.
Yep. Back to the spoiler.
That's right. Back to the spoiler. You want to deal with Bildad's main message?
Yeah, let's go there. What's Bildad's main message?
It's simple. Bad things happen to those who cross God. The very fact that you've lost so much, you have really crossed God. Mm-hmm.
And that's, he's got it backwards. Actually, maybe not so much backwards. He has it inside out. Because while bad things happen to everybody,
mm-hmm.
but good things await those who love God. I think he's got it completely inside out.
Job had already explained his perspective early on in the book.
Yep.
In the statement that he made to his wife, when his wife basically didn't like the situation, but what wife does, okay, when she loses all of her security and she loses her children, which is her relationship, her very purpose for being alive.
Especially in a culture that makes her property, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Well, what we have here is that Job went through the very same thing that his wife did. But Job had a different perspective than his wife did. Job's perspective was is that God can give and God can take away. Blessed is the name of God. And that's what he told his wife. You need to still bless God because it's his prerogative.
It is.
However, who do you think is the most important in this picture, in this scenario? Who is the most important? It's the wife. The wife is just thinking about what she lost, not what Job lost. And the fact is there's no explaining it. There's no rationale to it.
No,
Emotions don't listen well to logic.
Don't I know it? So the wife doesn't get it. She accosts him. She says, curse God and die. Those are hard words even to say.
Do you know what the implications are?
They're terrible.
Worse than that.
They're worse than terrible.
Your words reveal your heart.
They do.
And Job's wife revealed her heart. Mm-hmm. Her heart was basically a heart of cursing God. She not only told Job to curse God and die, she told Job, you curse God and you go to hell with him.
Yeah, that's that's just not right. But it seems that Bildad would kind of agree with her in that respect, that it's God's fault, or you did something bad, and now God's punishing you. You might as well just go that direction. But it's interesting because Bildad also talks about the blessings. He talks about the blessings.
He talks about conditional benefits.
Okay.
Conditional benefits, not blessings, conditional benefits. You do this, God does that. You do this, God does that.
Right.
You don't do this, God does this.
Right. I mean, it's the same kind of black and white logic that, you know, kindergarten teachers teach their students about the rules and how to treat people. It's everything's very black and white.
Do you know what this is? This is a template for religion. Do it this way, yep, or else.
Yeah. Yep. And if you do it this way, and you do it this way well enough, boy, is everything going to be good for you.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds like a prosperity gospel.
We have what I classify as a contemporary Christian perspective by a pastor that will remain unnamed for this broadcast.
A wise man.
Right. However, Bildad is missing something. He's the grandson of Abraham.
Yes, he is.
Bildad says no man can be righteous before God. But yet, what did God say about Abraham?
Abraham was called righteous. He was called friend of God.
Friend of God. So Bildad probably didn't know his grandfather really well in his relationship with God. But can a man have right standing with God prior to Jesus Christ?
Yes.
Give me some examples of men who had right standing with God before Jesus Christ. First person.
Well, Abraham.
Before that,
Abel.
Abel, who else?
Enoch.
Who else?
He
Noah. Built a boat. Yeah, built a boat.
He built a boat.
Okay.
Noah built a boat.
Who also had right standing with God? One more.
One more?
One more.
Only one more. Who do I choose?
He got to have the highest class ride at Disneyland, but it was sponsored by God.
Elijah. Yeah. There's so many more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Elijah brings with Elisha. Then you're talking about the time of kings. So there's David in there and mm-hmm. Daniel, you know, during the Babylonian exile. You've got Daniel and his three friends are all righteous. And yeah.
You know, in my notes, but I don't know if it's in these notes or some other notes that I had, that David got churned around on this whole thing, okay? Because David himself couldn't understand why he was being persecuted by his own family, Absalom specifically. David couldn't understand why Saul was wanting to kill him. So, there's more that meets the eye.
There is.
And usually the thing that meets the eye, that doesn't meet the eye, is usually bathed in the darkness of sin.
Yeah.
Saul's problem was the darkness of sin. Absalom's attacks were based upon the presence of sin.
Yep. Yep.
Well, let's talk about people who suffer. Is there any lesson from Job about people who suffer?
Well, Job as a whole has lots of good lessons for people who suffer, but right at the end, I think this is what you're referring to, right at the end of Bildad's speech, he says that God will not reject a blameless person. He won't take the hand of evildoers. He will yet fill your mouth with laughter and your lips with shouts of joy, and those who hate you will be clothed with shame, and the tent of the wicked will be no more. And when you're reading through this, you know, Bildad has that dark perspective. And so it really reads as sarcastic or cynical. They're words that are laced with poison, is really what it sounds like to me. But it's incredibly prophetic at the same time, because not only is Job fully and completely restored plus extra, but contemporarily, as Christians, we are promised persecution. And we are promised hardships and hard times. Jesus says, when the world hates you, just remember, they hate you because they hated me first. And we may not see the rewards during this lifetime, but the rewards are there and they're eternal.
If you were Bildad and I was Job, because Job says this to Bildad, he says, instead of you beating me up, if you call yourself my friend, why don't you just pray for me? Okay?
Yeah.
I don't need for you to attack me. If you're my friend, pray for me. Then Job will say, you know, I'm the guy who's suffering here,
yep,
not you. But he'll say, you know, you're saying I'm suffering because what I did to make God unhappy. But that's not the case, because I didn't do anything to make God unhappy. I didn't do anything wrong, and I'm sticking to the truth. Mm-hmm. You want me to admit to a lie just to get this thing over with. Not gonna do it. Not for you, not for anyone else.
Yep.
At least Eliphaz tried to provide me with a philosophical answer to try to understand this. But you, you're coming here with guns blazing, sharp knives drawn. Thanks, but no thanks. The next that you're going to say is my children deserve to suffer because of the fact that they're my children. I don't buy that. I pray for my children.
Right.
And the thing is that you have no right attacking my children, because this is between you and me. Mm-hmm. You're not even considering God in this equation. You're just using him as the whipping post.
Well, it's clear, crystal clear, that Bildad does not actually know much about God. He doesn't know God's character. He doesn't know God's sovereignty. And he certainly doesn't know God's heart.
That's right. I was going to say, I have a note here, and I'll just read it to you.
Okay.
Okay. God allows suffering to bring us closer to him by exposing impurity in our life as a refiner's fire does.
Yep.
Do you know what a refiner's fire is?
I do. Actually, I read an article on that not all that long ago where there was a ladies' Bible study that was going through the Psalms, and they came through that, they came across that refined by fire. And one of them decided that she wanted to know more about that. She wanted to understand that more in depth. And so she called a local person who did refining, you know, a jewelry maker or something of the trade, and didn't explain why, just asked to come and watch and work and understand the process. And she remarked about the steps in the process and the attention that he paid to every single detail. He had to burn it to just the right temperature. Too cool would leave impurities, and too hot would ruin the metal. And he said it's got to be just the right temperature to know it's done. And she asked him, how do you know it's done? And this is a part that caught me on it. He says, I know it's done when I can see myself in it. The silver, the gold that he's working with becomes a perfect mirror.
No impurities.
No impurities whatsoever. He can see himself perfectly in it. And isn't that an amazing analogy?
Do you know what refiner's fire actually lends itself to?
What's that?
Holiness. Mm-hmm. You become holy by going through the fire. And the fire is oftentimes suffering. But you never would know that what your impurities are until the time that you're tested. And the question is do you want to come out true? Do you want to come out holy? Do you want to come out to be of use to the Master? Or do you want to stay impure?
Right. Yeah, that's...
Here's another thing that I put down here. I'm not going to talk about children because that's a whole other topic that I'll get into in class about why children suffer.
Okay.
However, there is a clue that Jesus tells us in the New Testament, and it goes back to the story about why was this man born blind as a child.
Yep.
Okay, and sometimes it's not about us.
Sometimes
it's not about us.
As I recall, he was born blind in order to display the glory of God.
The glory of God. Another refiner's fire. Okay?
Yep.
Here's a statement that I have for us today.
Okay.
We have no need for faith if we have all the answers and can do everything for ourselves. Can you have eternity by yourself?
I was just having a conversation the other day with somebody, and if you know everything, then you don't have faith. You have knowledge. If we know everything, there's no more room for faith.
Faith has another word tied to it.
What's that?
Dependency.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and the fact is nobody wants to really admit that they're weak enough where they have to depend upon another person, especially depend upon God.
And that dependence and that faith requires trust. And small ways, big ways, sideways, long ways, people around us break trust.
Are you the same age today as you were 10 years ago?
No.
So what does that tell you about your time?
It's growing shorter.
You are finite.
Right.
Eternity has an aspect to it that you cannot have on your own.
Eternity has an aspect I can't even fathom.
It's called infinite.
I know.
So the question is... if you think you have all the answers and you can create your own eternity, it's only as good as long as you last.
Yep. That's very true. That is very true. Okay. So bringing it back around, back to Bildad, back to the very beginning where he calls Job a windbag. What kind of witness are you? Are you going to be a comforter, or are you going to be a tormentor? Because it is a choice, and it's a choice that we have to make just about every day, because there's people hurting in this world all around us. Are we going to comfort those that we see in need, or are we going to torment those? And I would actually put out that when it comes to those who are closest to us and that we love the most, we ironically tend to become tormentors more than comforters. We tend to be better comforters to those we don't know.
If you focus on the negative, you will be negative. If you focus on the negative, you will say negative things. If you focus on what is pure, good, holy, right, you will speak of those things. So the question is where's your focus? Who are you? Are you a human being living in the darkness of this world, the negative of this world? Or do you have your eyes looking up? Are you hearing from Jesus? Do you know what Jesus would say?
We've always got a good idea of what Jesus would say in situations. What would he say about you? What would he say about how you react?
All I want Jesus to say to me is welcome. I do not want to hear the word depart. Okay? Nothing else matters. Other than the fact is the fact that I am under his blood, seen as perfectly forgiven in spite of my weaknesses and yours.
All I want to hear is well done.
You're not bringing anything else with you. The only person who's showing up is just you. You know, one time I was sitting talking with another gentleman, and we were talking about three people who all were standing before Jesus at the same time. They had all died approximately at the same time, and they were all standing before Jesus. And one was an attorney. One was a very prominent businessman. Mm-hmm. And the other person was just a common day laborer. And Jesus asked this question. He first turned to the attorney, and he said to the attorney, "Why should I let you into my heaven?" And the attorney says, "Well," he says, "I've defended a lot of people." He says, "I've done a lot of good in life by getting people not to have to pay what they should have paid. You should let me into your heaven because of the good that I've done to help other people." And Jesus says, "Very good." He says, "I appreciate what you said." He says, "Go over there, over to that side." Man didn't know what that meant, went over there. Second man, Jesus says, "What are you driving there?" He says, "This is my Lamborghini." And Jesus says, "Is that doing you very good?" He says, "Oh yeah, I love my Lamborghini." Jesus says, "Well, we don't have many of those here in this heaven." He says, "Tell me, why should I let you into my heaven?" And the man says, "Well, that's easy." He says, "I'm successful. I did everything right. I made all this money. Look at all that I have." Jesus says, "Well, that's a very good explanation." He says, "I want you to go over there and sit with that gentleman." Next gentleman gets up, and he don't look very good or anything. And Jesus says, he says, "Son, tell me about yourself." He says, "Who are you and why should I let you into my heaven?" And the man dejectedly says, Jesus, he says, "I wouldn't blame you if you didn't let me into your heaven because I'm not like any of those two. I never did anything that anybody could really make notice of or speak of." He says, "All I can say is Jesus, this is that I just believed what you taught. And that's where I stand." He says, "I just want to believe in you. I don't want anything that those guys have, and I don't have anything that those guys have to bring to you." And Jesus says, "You, over on this side." And he turned to the other two, and he says, "Gentlemen, you're overqualified for heaven.
Yep. Somewhere along the lines, being a goat became a good thing.
That's right. The last shall be first, and the first, they won't even get to play.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Steve, what do you got in store for the lesson next week?
Well, right now, we're doing this dialogue with Bildad.
Okay.
Okay. We're going to actually back into a little more of this dialogue with Bildad before we see Job's response. You almost have to repeat what Bildad is saying here in 8 to be able to understand where Job is coming from in chapter 9. And you'll just have to come to the class to find out, or listen to next week's podcast, which will give you some clues, but only just clues.
Ooh. A teaser for a teaser.
That's exactly right.
All right, Steve, thank you so much for coming
in. Thank you,
today.
Dustin. Have a good day.
You too.